that type of budget, you should have two riders that are capable of winning. Because Chris, one crash, boom, he's out.
What went wrong last year? I crashed. I fell off my bike.
Halfway through the massage, there's a knock on the door, and it's Ryder, standing there with a cup for me. Made you a juice, Dave.
What's quite worrying is we're still in Derbyshire, and it feels like we've been cycling for a week.
Morale good, though?
No, not really.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the velodrome.
What velodrome?
The Roubaix velodrome. The outdoor velodrome in Roubaix. Outdoors.
And what's just happened here, Lionel?
The 2015 Paris-Roubaix has just finished. Podium presentation is going on now. Steve Arr of Etics Quick Step is stepping onto the second step of the podium now.
Greg Van Avermaet is on the third step. We're just waiting for the winner. We'll not spoil it. We'll not spoil the suspense because we've got a whole podcast coming up on this year's Paris-Roubaix. Lionel's been out on the course. I've been at the start and in the press room. And you were at the presentation as well, Lionel, before... the day before Paris-Roubaix. Still groups coming into the velodrome here several minutes after the race is finished. But yeah, you were at the presentation. You spoke to a few riders there. Can you introduce your interviews from there?
Yeah, I spoke to riders past and present, really. Dag Otto Lauritzen, a Norwegian rider. Not really a classic specialist, but he works for Norwegian TV these days. He had quite an interesting perspective on Alexander Kristoff, winner of the Tour of Flanders, of course. I spoke to Eric Zabel, former T-Mobile rider, probably better known for winning the green jersey in the Tour six times, I think. His son, Rick Zabel, was starting Paris-Roubaix for the first time as a Neo Pro for BMC Racing.
I'll just pause it there, Lionel, before we come to these interviews. We'll maybe just hear the announcement of the winner. Spoiler alert, should have said that before he was called to the top step of the podium. That gave the game away. John Degenkolb, who featured in a little special cycling podcast last week, an interview. He's won now two out of the three monuments so far this year, so it's a fantastic season. We'll talk about his victory a little bit later on. Let's go back to your interviews, Lionel.
Yeah, so we've got Dag Otto Lauritzen, we've got Eric Zabel, and we've got two riders from down under, I guess. Jack Bauer from New Zealand, Cannondale Garmin rider, and Matt Heyman, former Sky rider, the Australian now with Orica Greenedge.
And they were talking in Compiègne, where the race started on Sunday, and the presentation was on Saturday, and Lionel caught up with them there.
Eric Zabel.
Do you have a favourite memory of Paris-Roubaix from your career?
Of course. Pain.
Where does the pain start?
Mostly after the 200 kilometer mark, you get slowly tired, and then the cobbles, sometimes the wind, the weather makes you tired.
Dag Otto Lauritzen.
For me, Paris-Roubaix is one of the biggest classics, really maybe the biggest. It's a lot of action, it's a very tough race. People say you need luck, but you have to be smart too. You have to have good teammates. It's very dangerous, a lot of crashes, and I think the strongest man win anyway.
Jack Bauer.
The speed that you enter the first section is always really high because everybody's fresh and the whole pello is there. Yeah, of course, it's something new. I'm used to riding on bumps and stones, but on a mountain bike, never on a road bike.
Yes, there are many tough races in the circuit, but riding Roubaix is like slowly dying because you just run out of energy, and it's more or less every year the same, that just the strongest riders survive.
So my strong memories, you know, it's bad weather, but I loved bad weather. One morning we wake up here in Compiègne and there was snow on the ground. I can't remember which year, but I liked it, and most riders don't like it. So half of the peloton is beaten, but the guys who is starting in Paris-Roubaix, they know they are going to have a tough day. And tomorrow maybe they say sun, but maybe tailwind. And tailwind is not an advantage. tailwind makes the race harder, because when you have a strong headwind, you can protect yourself behind in the group. When there's tailwind, it's going faster and it's really more dangerous. So I think with tailwind, we're going to have a very interesting race.
it was just a madhouse, crazy. Like they say, hell on wheels. It's just, of course, it was fast, it was dusty, it's noisy, the crowds are huge. It's an atmosphere unlike anything I'd ever seen before in mountain biking or anything on the road. It's a unique one-off event. It's very special.
Matt Heyman.
Worst memory is probably giving my wheel to Fletcher before the Forest and riding the last 60k solo and finishing last. But yeah, and then I actually crashed, hit a spectator on Carrefour de l'Arbre, just so I was 10 minutes behind the last group and hit a spectator crossing the road, and then you wonder what you're doing actually, if you probably should have just got off like everybody else at the second feed. But no, it's a love, so I'd really like finishing this race.
Yeah, you want to reach the velodrome, I guess.
Yeah, I think everybody does. I think, well, most of the guys do. I mean, I think the days are gone too that the Spanish teams come here and the whole team's in their car. There's even Spanish riders that love being in this race, and I think most guys want to see the velodrome.
A lot of the flat sections in Flanders are, you know, they're over very fast, and the stones are quite different. They don't look like they've been there forever, you know, like when you go into the Arenberg, it looks like the stones have been there since the beginning of time almost, and when you hit them at speed, it's just a case of hanging on for, you know, for dear life. Yeah, you can't compare that to anything else.
For me, it's a bit like Christmas. It's an exciting day, and it's also, you know, it's all about to happen, and at the end of the day, that's it. There's a bit of a big letdown at the end of this, knowing that you have to wait another year, and me getting towards the end of my career, how many more chances do you get to do it? So, yeah, the anticipation of hoping things go right, you know, I don't need good luck. I just prefer not to have bad luck.
The rocks are that jagged, often look like they're misplaced. Big tire swallowing gaps in the middle of them, a real crown to the road that you need to find the center of if you're gonna ride a straight line. It's there's obviously an art to riding the stones, and it's definitely something I'm looking to master, if not this year, then the coming years.
And do you have any lucky charms, or do you not believe in luck, or is tomorrow one of those days where luck counts?
I've been asked that all my career, and I used to always say no, and then the other day I went to pin my numbers on, and I thought, no, I won't pin them on the night before. There's riders that do and don't, and I definitely won't pin my numbers on until the day of the race. So
brilliant.
I didn't think I had anything, but I actually pulled myself up, so maybe I do.
If you are lucky because your captain has no material problem and you can stay on his side for a long time, of course, then you can learn a lot. Races like the Ronde or here Roubaix are really special days. Classics are always special, and be nervous because it's always good. Enjoy the race day. Eat enough, drink enough during the race. In every moment when you have the possibility to do that, fill up your stomach with energy, because you will need it.
I was at the start of Paris-Roubaix in Compiègne this morning, in the beautiful grounds of the palace in Compiègne. It was quite low-key, actually. Not an awful lot of people around. I think most people who come to watch Paris-Roubaix go out to the pavé, to the sectors of pavé, to watch it there. Far more sort of exhilarating, and obviously you can skip around and see it at different points. But quite a nice atmosphere. I spoke to Matt Heyman as well, and got around a few different people. But you were out on the actual course, weren't you?
I've done this quite a few times before, trying to see the race in multiple different places. It is possible because there's a kind of a network of motorways that kind of go parallel and crisscross the route, so you can drive, see it in one place, get back in the car, drive up the main road or the motorway, get out, see it again. You need to have pretty good map reading skills. A little bit of local knowledge helps. The sat nav was very helpful, but we managed to see it in two places. That was what we set out to do. We thought a third sighting would be a bonus, but we wanted to get here to the velodrome to see the finish. So myself and our photographer Simon Gill were out, and we saw it at Trois-Villes, which was the opening section of cobbles, and then we saw it at Hornang, which was sector number 16. We had hoped to try and get to the Arenberg Forest, but because of the tailwind, the race was so quick, we realised we weren't going to be able to get far enough in front of them to be able to park, and obviously we were observing all speed limits and traffic rules and all of that kind of thing, so we were a little bit more conservative. But it was great. I mean, the fantastic weather, the fact that there was a tailwind, made it a fast race, made it quite spectacular, lots of dust being thrown up. But because of the great weather, loads of people were out doing the same thing. So there was sort of a procession of cars getting back onto the main roads and then ducking back in to try and see the race on the cobbles.
So the race, Lionel, the race. I mean, being out on the course, you might not have been able to follow it all that closely. I spent a good bit part of the day driving from Compiègne to here in Roubaix. It was a similar race to the Tour of Flanders in a way, and a similar type of winner, a guy renowned as a sprinter, John Degenkolb, winning it in a sort of unconventional way. He took off, he took the race by the scruff of the neck, just as Alexander Kristoff did in Tour of Flanders. Kristoff was the first Norwegian winner of the Tour of Flanders. I think Degenkolb was the second German winner after the very first edition.
Yeah, Joseph Fischer won in 1896.
Of course, Joseph Fischer, great writer.
Right, a friend of the podcast, if there had been such a thing. Friend of the wireless back in the day, no doubt.
He's an honorary friend of the podcast.
Being out there on the course gives you a completely different perspective and not an entire picture of the race. I only caught perhaps the last 25 or 30 kilometres on television after getting here to Roubaix. But what you do get from seeing the race at the first section of cobbles, and we were waiting at the end of that section of cobbles, you can just see how much the guys at the front really want to put the hammer down and make it hard as soon as they reach the cobble section. And the bunch was strung out into a huge long line, making it very, very difficult to get from the back to the front. You know, you're talking about hundreds of metres to try and close the gap from the back to the front, and that's really where the race starts. And then to see them again another, what, hour and 20 minutes later in the race, the thing you learn when you go out and you see the race in two separate places, an hour and a half apart, is just how much the race changes between those two points. And then obviously if you were able to then see it a third or a fourth time, you know, it's a completely different event, really. It feels like you're watching something different. It doesn't feel like when you watch on TV, you watch the evolution of a race over 2-3 hours, all the little pieces make sense and you can join them all together and you understand the story. When you see it in two isolated places, following only Twitter to keep up with what's going on, it's an exhilarating experience being out there. And I think, you know, we cover the sport, you know, all year round, go to lots of different races. It's not something you have the luxury to do at the Tour de France, but on a day like this, it really sort of puts you back in touch with how the sport actually works and how the races actually, you know, are run.
There is something very, very special too about being here in the velodrome where, you know, the race has always finished, just about, to watch the sprint, to watch Degenkolb win, to know that he's following in the wheel marks of, you know, I was watching Bernardino's 1981 victory, you know, and just to, it puts it in that context, doesn't it? And for all that, it just, they're just blokes on bikes, the awareness that they're sort of creating history is quite a special feeling that I don't think the novelty of that really wears off. Or if it does, you probably shouldn't be here, I think.
No, I think also it's a sense of place, isn't it? I know Paris-Roubaix, there was a few years in the 80s when it finished out on a main road somewhere on the outskirts of town for commercial reasons. It finished outside a clothing factory, I think, that sponsored the race. Larredoux was a clothing company that sponsored the race, and they wanted it to finish there. But this is the place where Paris-Roubaix concludes. I mean, like you say, yeah, that is it's as evocative as the summit of Alpe d'Huez, more so, in fact, because more riders have won here and more editions of this race have concluded here. And so, yeah, it's absolutely, you know, it's Wembley Stadium, the old Wembley Stadium for cycling, really.
It's cracking, as Daniel might say. Let's hear, shall we, from Luke Rowe, who was eighth. An outstanding performance from him, caps a great spring. And also, after Luke Rowe, we'll hear from Andy Fenn. Luke, what do you take personally from the spring? You were up there in Het Nieuwsblad, you're still up here today. What do you take from a very strong spring campaign?
To finish like that is super for me. I got top 10 in Nieuwsblad, top 10 here, just outside top 10 in E3. And yeah, so I can take a lot from it, and I just feel like I really started to step up now. And I think, you know, this is my dream. This is, for me, this is the biggest and the best race by a million miles away, by a million miles, even bigger than Flanders in my eyes. That's just a personal thing. And it's my dream to one day be on that podium, you know. So I think, you know, my third attempt at the race, and the first year I didn't get a true hit out with a puncture on the first section, so my second real attempt. So, you know, hopefully it proves that one day I can do that. But, you know, at the same time, I'll I think it's a top 10. I haven't had it confirmed, but I'll take that for now.
There's, as you said, a big improvement in the team's performance in these races this year. What do you put that down to?
I think it's just been a long time coming, you know. We had that classic squad from 3-4 years ago. And if you look at the team, there hasn't been many changes. There hasn't been many guys coming in and out. We've just built and grown together. And that group is so tight, you know, where we got there and we raced together. But, you know, we're best of mates. I mean, like, end of the season, we go away for a weekend on the piss together. And it's more than just bike riding. I think, you know, when you really get together as a group like that and, you know, you become mates off your bike as well, then you really gel. And, you know, that extra bit of determination that you're willing to go that extra mile for your mate, I think, you know, I think that's the difference.
Andy Fenn, you look like you've had a hard day out there.
Yeah, it's a pretty hard day. I was chasing a lot with, Luke's done a good ride today, that's for sure. Had a bit of bad luck with G crashing, and it's one of those things, it's Roubaix, I guess.
You're a former junior winner of this race, so you joined Team Sky to ride these races. You know, you were at what was a Quickstep team. You weren't really getting your chance there. You must be pleased to have been selected for the team for these kind of races.
Yeah, the classics are really stepping up in Sky, and actually we've got one of the best teams now, I think. You know, you've seen from the classics we've done, we've had G winning, Stannard winning, you know, Luke's up there today, and I think we just keep pushing him in the group we've got, we can surely do a lot more in these races. Even, you know, I think if we didn't have that crash in San Remo, Swift could have had a better chance. So we've had a quite good classic season, really, and I think it's just going to keep stepping up. We're all young guys, so it's going to be good to be part of it.
What's it been like with, obviously, Wiggins is retiring from Team Sky now? What's it been like the last couple of weeks with him?
It's been good to be part of, actually. I've never really raced with him. The first time I saw him was in Qatar. And then, he's been pretty on form, actually, this couple of weeks, laughing and joking. And, it's actually been good to be part of.
And next year, I mean, you'll be looking at a team maybe led by Geraint Thomas, Stannard and Luke Rowe as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think we've got guys to fill his place, and we're all young guys, all stepping up. You know, maybe there'll be a few guys coming in. Maybe Swift is a possibility, I think. So there'll be a few changes next year, but if, you know, there's still that core group of us that are still slowly progressing, and you see what's happened this year, so I think we're just on the up, really.
So you have a rest now. What's likely to be your next target?
Well, I'll be riding Yorkshire and California and then have a rest. I've got a baby coming next week, so I'll probably have a bit of a rest there. But, or maybe not. Yeah, I'll keep training these next couple of weeks. So I've got a big break, actually, when the Giro's on. So that's all I can do, really. Just keep going another couple of weeks, do those races, and then I'll have a bit of a break.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Van Dessel Cycles. Van Dessel, ride inspired.
Let's talk a little bit about Bradley Wiggins. Now, there was an awful lot of attention, some might say hype, around Bradley Wiggins, his final race for Team Sky. He will now revert to his new team, Team Wiggins, and concentrate largely on the track, although we'll all see him at the Tour de Yorkshire. But this was his final appearance on this big stage. And there were a lot of people, including myself, really uncertain as his condition, his form. And I must say, I wasn't particularly feeling all that confident in his form after Friday, when we went to 48 hours before Paris-Roubaix, went to a pre-arranged press conference. It had been set up a week before, 3 o'clock in the afternoon at the hotel in Cortrick, and we turned up, the journalists, and were told by the Team Sky press officer that Bradley Wiggins had decided he wasn't going to speak to the press after all. Now, a lot of people had come long distances, TV crews setting up, etc., etc. A lot of people gone to a lot of effort and expense to get there, and he was upstairs in his bedroom, and it seemed a little bit unacceptable.
That is quintessential Bradley Wiggins, isn't it? You know, there's an appointment, loads of people have come to see you, and you don't feel like turning up. I mean, and then in a sort of an unscheduled appointment, he can be the most engaging person there is, and one of the most quotable people in the sport. So that doesn't surprise me in the least, really. But I remember just before Christmas, we did a live event, Richard, in Nottingham, I think, and one of the questions from the floor was whether Bradley Wiggins could win Paris-Roubaix, and I was absolutely certain and said no. But I have to say, over the last 3-4 months, there have been moments when I thought perhaps the stars are going to align and perhaps he is going to do it. It didn't really work out that way, and as we've talked about a lot in the podcast, Paris-Roubaix is one of those races where you have to really grasp your opportunity and give it absolutely everything, as John Degenkolb did, really. If you look back at his little move there, going across to two riders who were already there, it's very easy to suggest that perhaps that's wasting energy ahead of the sprint. Why not wait to see if somebody else brings it together? But in the time Degenkolb, had he waited for it to all come together, that move could have disappeared up the road. And I think the one regret with Bradley Wiggins is, particularly last year's Paris-Roubaix, the moment to win that race was when Nicky Terpstra attacked, and if he'd made that move at that moment, he could well have won it last year. And I think somebody said to me at Paris-Nice that Bradley Wiggins, the race he really wants to win is the 2014 Paris-Roubaix, because everything was there for him, whereas it didn't really work out that way for him today.
I think he deserves a lot of credit. I mean, going back to the press conference, I thought that his reluctance to meet the press was perhaps a sign of his own doubts. I mean, we saw this before the 2010 Tour de France, where he sort of disappeared into his shell, and as we later found out, I think that was a sign of his anxiety, and the anxiety owed to his doubts over his form, and that's what was proven at the Tour. And I wondered if it was a parallel situation there. He did actually come down and speak to us for 10 minutes, but he wasn't in his best sort of mood or humour, and so he seemed distracted, he seemed anxious, and I wondered about, you know, whether it was because he really felt like he hadn't got it right. And I'm not convinced, having watched him race, that he did get it right in terms of physical preparation. But I think he deserves a lot of credit for the heart that he showed, the determination that he showed, because he seemed at various points of the race to be out of it. And he clawed his way back, and he did attack with about 30 kilometres to go. A good move, you know, which we've seen in the past with Bonin, with Cancellara, that a move from that far out can work. And certainly that was perhaps the sort of move that Bradley Wiggins had to launch to win. He did get a gap. It seemed like a good move. He looked strong. He was doing most of the work. He had a few riders with him. It didn't work, but at least he had a go, you know. And I think when he reflects on the race, I think he'll be glad that he did give it a go.
Oh, absolutely. It's his last day racing at this level. And, you know, not to take away from this sort of emotional aspect of that as well. This is the last time you have to put yourself through this. There won't be too many 265-kilometre road races going over 27 sections of cobbles in his, you know, the next and final phase of his career. This is all done for him now. So, yeah, he had nothing to lose, and he did give it a go. But like you, Richard, I think, you know, Team Sky, they had several potential riders, and obviously Luke Rowe finishing eighth, Geraint Thomas, by the looks of it, had some pretty terrible luck, crash and a couple of punctures, I think. Wiggins, you know, he was there, but not quite there enough, if you see what I mean, to get onto the podium.
No, I think they've got this problem, Sky. I mean, Geraint Thomas was ruled out with crashes and so on, two punctures and a heavy crash. Ian Stannard, as Andrew McQuaid told us, perhaps not at the form he was in at Het Nieuwsblad, which he won. But, you know, they've got several strong riders around them, one outstanding leader, and you know, we've seen with obviously Christoph, Degenkolb, these guys are undisputed leaders of their teams because they can finish races as well, and as they've shown the last couple of weeks, they can finish races in ways that we perhaps don't expect.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Lionel, we're going to play a little bit of an interview I did with Edwin Bull, the owner of Van Dessel Cycles, because we owe them a special thanks. We've been trying to bring you a better podcast this year, a more regular podcast. We're doing a Friends special podcast from the Cobble Classics, Tour of Flanders, Skelderprace, the midweek Cobble Classic, and today's Paris-Roubaix. That will be available this coming week if you join up as a friend, sign up as a friend at thiscyclingpodcast.com. It will cost you a measly £5. And this will be our third Friends special, and we've got several more planned. But it's thanks to our sponsors, British Eurosport and Van Dessel Cycles, that we've been able to come out and cover these races as well, as thanks to the friends, of course. So we're very grateful to them, and we're going to tell you a little bit about Van Dessel because a few of you have asked. They're a sort of cult company in the US and not perhaps so well known in the UK and in Europe. So we'll hear a little bit from Edwin Bull. I spoke just now to Koen de Kort, the teammate of John Degenkolb on Giant Alpecin. He's always sort of one of the main men for either Degenkolb or Marcel Kittel. A very loyal and very strong teammate. Obviously, he was jubilant in the aftermath of the race, and I caught up with him just after he'd got off the podium, having been asked to join Degenkolb there on the top step. Teammate over there, John Degenkolb. I think not a huge surprise that he won the race. We knew he was capable of winning it, but perhaps a surprise the way that he won it. Were you surprised?
Well, obviously, I haven't seen too much of, say, the last 15 kilometres. My job was done when the Carrefour de l'Arbre started. So up to there, he managed to take it pretty easy, and you know, his teammate. So I reacted to a lot of breaks and closed a few gaps and brought him to the front. And we had in the final then Ramon Sinkeldam and Bert Tabaka for that as well. So we had plenty of guys there to do his dirty work. And then towards the end, I heard he closed the gap to two guys in a breakaway in an impressive manner. And I think Stibar came back and yeah. Suppose he beat him in the sprint. So, you know,
it was seven in the end, but he had really taken the race by the scruff of the neck, you know, and attack rather than just wait for the sprint.
I guess he was going to have to. It was always the best tactic for him, I guess, because, you know, if he's going to wait, then they're going to attack him, and then everyone's going to look at him to react and close it. So, you know, it's probably best. He's probably best off just to go on the attack and have the rest chase him instead of the other way around.
Was Christophe maybe a concern as well?
Well, there were quite a lot of riders that were really good, but Christophe has been in incredible shape lately, and he's obviously one of these guys that could get close to beating him in the sprint. So it was definitely a concern, but he was on a list of another couple of riders, and we started to race trusting in ourselves and trusting that we could win this race, and we weren't really going to look at other riders, so we were just mainly going to see how we could do everything best.
What kind of leader is John? I mean, did he stand up on the bus this morning and sort of fill you with confidence that he was in sort of shape to win?
Yeah, well, he obviously showed already in San Remo that he's in great shape, and he kept on showing that, and he's one of those guys similar to Marcel Kittel, who's just an incredibly nice guy, and you always really want to work for him, and he always makes it worth it as well. He's so thankful. And just then on the podium, he asked his teammates up and hugs us all and thanks us all here, even on the podium. And I mean, that shows that he really appreciates what we do for him, and that's also the reason why it's so easy for us to do it. I mean, he's so thankful, and he makes it worth it.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast and British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
The cycling coverage continues on British Eurosport with the next big classic, the Amstel Gold Race, on Sunday the 19th of April. Then from the 21st, there's the 6-day Tour of Croatia. And on the 22nd, the first of the Ardennes doubleheader, Flèche Wallonne, followed a few days later, of course, by Liège-Bastogne-Liège. All on British Eurosport, the home of cycling. Now, I mentioned earlier in this podcast that we'd hear a little bit from Edwin Bull of Van Dessel Cycles, who have been sponsoring the podcast these last couple of months and whose support has allowed us to cover these cobbled classics, to come over and cover them, I should say. It seems appropriate because we've spent a lot of the past week or so in Belgium, and Edwin, who's the founder of the company, was born and originally brought up in Belgium. His family was a big cycling family before he moved to the US and began racing and then producing his own bikes. I wanted to find out a bit more about the bikes, so I called Edwin recently at Van Dessel HQ in New Jersey. As I said, it's a cult brand in the US, but they have ambitions to grow, and I started by asking Edwin about the company's growth strategy.
Well, it's finding distributors, but you know, basically making very high-quality, high-value bikes. And again, performance-oriented. So we're not going to make bikes with a very tall head tube and a very short top tube. I tend to joke that we make bikes for people who can still touch their toes. But it seems a lot of the mass, I don't want to say mass market frames, but mass produced frames from the big companies tend to go very much after a weekend warrior sort of market, which is where a lot of the focus is. We tend to stay more performance oriented. So basically we're making, you know, really nice performance bikes that you get a lot of bang for your buck. And the reviews we've been getting on the bikes has been fantastic. So
Lionel, we're still here in the Velodrome at Roubaix. We were recording stuff earlier on for the Friends Special podcast with our good friend Ciro Scognamileo. Hoped he would join us again regular.
He'll be tapping away on his laptop in the press room, won't he, by now?
Who's he going to be writing about? What, were there any Italians up there?
Pippo Pozzato got into the bus nice and early. So that's a big story for Gazzetta.
Yep. Yeah, so listen, let's talk about the winner, John Degenkolb. Outstanding win, an outstanding season. Daniel has been tipping him for Etics Quick Step. They leave these spring cobbled classics empty-handed, which is not good news at all for Patrick Lefebvre. Shame we couldn't catch up with him. I'm sure he'd be in great humour.
I saw him sort of skulking about in the middle of the velodrome here a little bit earlier. He didn't look in the best of humours, it has to be said. But, you know, never knowingly takes defeat well, does he, Patrick Lefebvre?
Not really, no. If we see him, we'll try and catch him. I'm sure that will be priceless. John Degenkolb, though.
I saw on Twitter, I can't attribute this to somebody because I can't remember who said it, but Degenkolb was quoted as saying that he wanted to win Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix in the same spring because his great hero Sean Kelly had done that. That was in 1986.
Funny you should say that, because Ciro said earlier to me only one rider has won Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix, but he couldn't remember who it was.
In the same year, yeah.
That's what he said.
Kelly, is Kelly the one that's done that? Yeah, he may well be. We'll have to check that. But Degenkolb has won it in the velodrome. I think Kelly's win in 86 came out, as I was saying earlier, on a nondescript road somewhere on the outskirts of Roubaix. So
I wonder, has there ever been a podcast where you've not had some Sean Kelly fact to be able to drop in?
Yes, there have been some.
I can't remember them. If any listeners can identify or find the podcast where there hasn't been a Sean Kelly fact. Sorry, Lionel.
This is a John Degenkolb fact. He's obviously inspired by Sean Kelly. He's probably of that age, isn't he, where he would have been growing up watching cycling.
He's a bit younger than
end, that. As Kelly was coming to the end, I guess.
He's quite a young man. We're older than you think, Lionel.
Yeah, I guess we are. Maybe you just watched some VHS videos of Sean Kelly.
I've heard of him. I'm sure he's read Hunger, the autobiography.
I'm sure he has. It's not been translated into German, but Degenkolb's English is excellent. I must make sure he gets a copy, actually, of that. Yeah. To win those two races, you asked me earlier who I thought I was going to win. That will be in the humour of that will be in the Friends special, me getting it hopelessly wrong. The obvious one to say before the race would have been John Degenkolb, but I just thought time had gone on a bit too far and that perhaps his peak, you know, he would have been over the top and on the way down. But he's clearly, you know, he just rode so intelligently. That's the thing. It's all very well saying, well, he's a great sprinter and he's got the beating of most people in a finish, and the gap was decisive. We were stood dead level with it, so we had a look right across at how
it's quite rare that you can see it side on, isn't it? It's so rare that you can actually just watch it across the field. Here we were watching them sprint side on, and you know, from this distance it looked quite slow. Not to take anything away from his victory.
No, it's funny, isn't it? Because it's actually a really dead surface to ride on. I've ridden round here a couple of times, and it's not a pleasant feeling. The bike doesn't roll really nicely, and of course they've all got sort of quite fat tyres on. Some of them have got knobbly tyres on. They've been riding for 6 hours, so it's not a sort of pure sprinter sprint. But I was saying, you know, it's easy to say Degenkolb, well, he's the fastest, so therefore he wins. But like Christophe in the Tour of Flanders, he made that victory. You know, everyone was criticising the Tour of Flanders a little bit, or some people were, for saying it wasn't the most dynamic race. It wasn't a real explosive attack. It was one of those ones that just slides off the front, which Alexander Christophe and Nicky Terpstra made last week in Flanders. But that was the move that made the race. And likewise here, Degenkolb, you know, he didn't just sit in and wait for the sprint. He went out and made that victory happen for himself.
As you said, Lionel, it was a smart victory, just as in Milan-San Remo, where, you know, he used his head there as well. And you know, he's still quite a young rider. He's, I think, 26. So We've talked a lot about how it can take years to mature to win these races, years of experience and the kind of strength and endurance you build up over time. So, you know, he's got 5, 6, 7, 8 years of contending in these races, perhaps.
And, yeah, from a team perspective for Giant Alpecin, Marcel Kittel is having an absolute shock of a spring, isn't he, with illness and what have you. And John Degenkolb has really deflected any kind of speculation or criticism or wonderings about Kittel's form completely away. You know, it's a bit like when the spotlight's on Mark Cavendish when he's not so good. You know, somebody from Etics Quickstep steps up and does the business, it deflects a bit of that attention away. So, but Giant Shimano, you know, they do race like a group. There's a sort of there's a spirit of HTC Columbia in there somewhere, isn't there? It's sort of they are a group that is well knit together, as we saw when they all went on the podium at the end.
And like HTC Columbia, they're certainly not the biggest budget team. You get the sense that they're almost on a shoestring, and that seems to almost galvanise them. And there is this great team spirit. I mean, it was interesting. Cohen de Cort said that what made Degenkolb and Kittel such effective leaders was actually the fact that they're very nice guys. I'm getting a lift home. I've got to rush off quite soon because I'm getting a lift home with Ned Bolting, who's just wandered into the velodrome here. Ned, have you had a good day?
That's great, yeah, loved it. We went to Sector 21.
You were over with your daughter, weren't you?
I was over with my little girl. She's just minding our bikes over there.
Great.
Yeah, first time I've actually gone out and watched, you know, done them both. I've been here before at the velodrome, but I've never seen them ride over the cobbles. And what makes the spectacle is just how close you get to the riders, because they all head for the gutters, don't they? Well, at least they did in my sector. And so,
safest place would be to stand right in the middle.
Yeah, well, virtually, yeah. But, I mean, you know, you are just inches away from them. And it was great. And then you hop
any particular riders or sights or spectacles catch your eye?
It's very hard to see. When you're actually on a race, it's very hard to keep track of what's going on. It's much easier when you're just in your living room watching it on the telly. It looked to me like Wiggins was virtually on his way out of the race at that point, and that was only, what, 130k in. He seemed to be sort of yo-yoing off the back of the bunch for a while. I don't know whether that was the case. I don't know whether Thomas had already gone down at that point, but Ian Stannard looked the best of the sort of Sky contingent, and the whole train, when they came past me at that point, was being driven on by Nicky Terpstra, who seems to have put in a huge amount of effort today. But yeah, great. I mean, when was the last have you done the stats? When was the last time such a big group came into the velodrome, do we know?
I think there were 7 of them, weren't there, in the end, sprinting out. It was quite a big group.
It's unusually big, isn't it?
Yeah, you were sitting in the stands, weren't you, watching the finish here. And you came over this morning. See, it was a day trip.
Last night. Came over last night and spent the night in Belgium, in Flanders. Yeah.
So thoroughly recommended to people.
What a trip.
You've been able to provide people an itinerary, bolting tours.
Well, there's so many ways of doing it. You know, it's such a cleverly designed route because the motorway just links the whole thing up. So you can get to the finish line in plenty of time. We were here with an hour and a half to spare. And there's so many little access points onto the race, and it's free. You know, I just think it's absolutely all right. There's a little ticketed bit over there, isn't there, in the grandstand, but other than that, you just rock up, which is just, you know, what other major sporting event on the global calendar does that apply to, apart from the London Marathon?
I must say, Ned, this is not that you can't see this because it's an audio production, but this is not the smooth, clean-shaven Ned Bolting that we see on our screens.
Downtime.
Yeah, you're wearing a few days stubble there. you're wearing a London Nocturne casket.
Yeah, I've probably.
I didn't know you let yourself go so much when you're not on television.
My career has slightly changed TV wise, and I might well have done my last football match. And there's two reasons why that's a good thing. One is I will never have to wear a suit while I'm broadcasting, a suit and tie ever again. And it opens up at least the possibility that I could go with a beard. That's all I'm saying. So at the moment, what you see here, and you rightly pointed out, it's a bit laughable. This is experimentation.
So it's not stubble. It's an early stages beard.
It's an effort. I mean, it's nothing compared to Lionel. It's just, you know, that's all good.
Ned lives in sort of hipster London, doesn't he? So, you know, it's...
It's John Degenkolb!
John Degenkolb. Walking.
You know, he was always going to win out of those 7, wasn't he? Despite that huge turn. Have you done all this? You've done your race
now. No, tell us what you thought.
Well, I just thought that effort to get across to... who's the Etics Quickstep rider?
Lampert.
It was Lampert and Van Van Avermaet, wasn't it? And then he did a whole load of work on the front of that group of three as well, didn't he? Because at one point it did look like they were going to start messing around and get caught. And then to execute it, I mean, it was perfect, wasn't he? I think it was third wheel as he came into the velodrome here. And from that moment on, it was Dagen Cole, wasn't it? It was a kind of... It almost looked effortless, and I'm delighted for him. I think he's a hell of a rider. And who's got primacy in that giant Albertine team now? Is it him or is it Marcel Kittel?
You know, at the moment it's him.
Well, it is absolutely, but that's because we're at that stage of the season and we're reflecting on these achievements. But you know, what a team they've got. And if Warren Barguil turns into the rider that everyone hopes he can be, then they're kind of firing on three cylinders, aren't they?
You know, they are more Juventus than Knox County or Newcastle United in their black and white stripes, aren't they? MTN Quebec.
I knew that when Ned mentioned football earlier, was a danger that would open up something. We have to hit the road.
We got a little while. Where's your bike?
Oh, it's in William Fullingham's car in my US
very messy.
In my US postal bike bag,
right?
Which I can't really, you know, got to wait for cover of darkness or something, I think, before I can retrieve that. Anyway,
What did you think of the race?
You'll have to listen to the podcast, Ned.
Well, I am a friend. I'm a friend of the podcast, which is, by the way, an excellent addition to your portfolio.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Okay, well, we're back in London. It's the day after Paris-Roubaix and Lionel and I have been joined by our old friend Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, chaps.
I think you were off winning a golf tournament at the weekend.
Yes, I'm glad you mentioned that, Rich. The 21st edition of the Saunton Tankard. A convincing victory, three shots. I was playing off four on the last day, still won.
Don't know what any of that means, but well done, Daniel. Did you manage to watch Paris-Roubaix, and what was your reaction to John Degenkolb's victory there?
I watched a few minutes of highlights. Sorry, chaps. I mean, you know, there was a weekend. I remember that you missed a big race, didn't you, Napalm? Lionel, for the benefit of our listeners.
That might be the first time you've called Lionel by his official nickname. In the podcast, you just outed him.
I think we let it slip out once. Are we going to explain why he's called Napalm? No, we're not.
We'll say that for a future episode,
for a friend's podcast. So I didn't see an awful lot of Paris-Roubaix. The winner, John Degenkolb, two monuments, first man since Sean Kelly to win those two. We'd spoken quite a lot about in the spring, hadn't we? We'd spoken about those rumours linking him with Etics Quickstep. Not a great campaign, classics campaign for them, although they rode very, very well. They seem to lack that finisher, which Degenkolb obviously is, in the absence of Boonen. He's tied still to Giant Alpecin for next year, but I'm sure that they will be very interested in talking to him in the early part of next year. If they are looking to size up someone for Boonen's role, because Boonen is obviously nearing retirement. One thing that stood out for me yesterday, the outstanding performances of a number of young riders. Yves Lampert, who we mentioned a few times this year for Etics Quickstep, he wasn't down to ride Flanders and Roubaix originally. They put him into the 3 days of West Flanders to sort of see how he got on there, because it's his first spring as a pro rider. He won that race and really proved his credentials as a classics rider. So he got picked for Flanders and Roubaix, was outstanding yesterday, really instrumental in Stibar's second place. Thies Benoot, obviously we mentioned last week at Flanders, outstanding. Two French riders, Alexis Goujard, another one we've mentioned on numerous occasions in the past for AG2R, was in the break in the morning, took a long time to get caught. And then Florian Seneschal of Cofidis. We don't talk much about Cofidis in positive terms, but he rode very well yesterday to finish 17th, I think.
There's another incident that Lionel and I didn't actually talk about when we were there. And it was partly because when you're at the race and covering it as a journalist, it's quite a challenge, isn't it? I mean, Lionel was jumping around from section of pavé to section of pavé. We also had to then scoot from the press room in the indoor velodrome to the into the outdoor velodrome, and missed a couple of crucial moments of the race, which we only caught up with afterwards. But the other major talking point, which continues to be a talking point, was the level crossing, which came down, and a lot of riders didn't stop. There may be repercussions from that.
Just on sort of the nuts and bolts of covering a race, you kind of go from the top line down, don't you, whenever you're a race, whether it's a one-day classic or a major tour. The big story of the day is yesterday was Degenkolb winning, closely followed by Bradley Wiggins' final race for Team Sky and his sort of retirement from this level. And then it's when the sort of you digest the other things that have happened a little bit later on. And I think it's only really been today that the day after the race that the significance of the level crossing jump has really kind of caught hold, partly because SNCF, the French rail company, has instructed the French police, or requested the French police, to take some kind of action over the riders who jumped the level crossing. We've seen riders do this in the past. Was it 2006 when Leif Hoster and Tom Boonen and one other...
Alessandro Ballan,
they went under or round the level crossing as it was closing and were disqualified from second, third and fourth place in the results in Paris-Roubaix. So it's not without precedent. What struck me yesterday was that the incident was quite serious because it was a TGV train. I'm not saying that a small local train isn't going to do quite considerable damage, but for the riders to take that much of a risk going under the barrier as it's falling and round the barriers as they are closed, it just shows you know, the mindset of a rider in the heat of battle, so to speak. You know, their priority is to get up the road and not be held back. I think it's only in the aftermath, you know, it's all very well to say, well, they neutralised the race, they allowed the second part of the peloton to catch up the first part of the peloton, no harm done. It's only afterwards that you can reflect on it with a cool head. At the time, you know, if I was an elite bike rider, a stretch of the imagination, I know, to imagine that, but if I was an elite competitor and my job was to be at the front of that bike race and the level crossing is coming down, I can't honestly say that I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that as myself because it's incredibly dangerous.
But in this case, the riders need to be protected from themselves by a very clear UCI protocol, don't they? They need to know exactly what the procedure is when this occurs in the race, because Paris-Roubaix is not the only race where it can occur in the course of a season. And as you say, they will, in the absence of any such rule or regulation, they will take those risks. And it is very dangerous and it looks terrible for the SNCF.
Oh, it sets a terrible example. It's been replayed on Sky Sports News here in the UK today because it's a dramatic-looking incident. But the thing is, the rule already exists. You're not allowed to ride under or round a closed or closing level crossing. So the challenge for the organisers is to identify all of the riders and disqualify all of them. You can't do some and not others, because that then doesn't send the message that you need to send, because if you disqualify some, others will think, well, it's possible to get away with it. So perhaps it makes a case for having better ways to identify which riders are which. Perhaps for a race like Paris-Roubaix, which does cross several train tracks, they need the numbers to be much bigger, much more easily identifiable from that kind of helicopter footage.
What about Velon? Were they filming yesterday? Anyone have on-bike cameras? Because that could be a useful tool
I don't think it would be very difficult to identify the riders. There's great footage of it. There's footage gone up today of under-23 riders doing exactly the same, even more dangerously, on Saturday in the under-23 Paris-Roubaix. So, you know, this is part of the culture of the sport. The way to change the culture, you know, you look at, you know, the recent rugby internationals, the culture in there is that you respect what the referee says, whereas the culture in football is you don't respect what the referee says. And if the culture in cycling is that going through a level crossing is automatic disqualification, riders won't do it. They won't do it if they know that that's the risk. It's as simple as that. That will be a greater disincentive than potential loss of life through being hit by a train, bizarrely. So, you know, and there's a lot of fury on Twitter and so on about the UCI not responding. I think give it time. You know, I don't think it needs necessarily an instant response from the UCI, but the rule has to be made clear and has to be enforced, and whether that's enforced retrospectively in this case or not, it needs to be made absolutely clear to riders that skipping a level crossing will mean disqualification.
So this is a sport, unfortunately, that's been bedeviled by people going through metaphorical level crossings and red lights for many years, isn't it?
Well, it was. It did sort of highlight the lengths that riders will go to. Anyway, we should wrap up there because we're going on a bit. I'm sure we'll be talking about this again. Daniel, thanks very much for briefly joining us. You'll be back for the full episode next week. There's far more from us from the Tour of Flanders and Pirate Bay in our Friends special, which will also be available this week. Sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Lots more interviews, analysis, if you can call it that, from those races. All three of us were at the two and Skeldeprace. So thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard and Napalm.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.